Did you know that as more people listen to WNYC on the internet, our bandwidth expenses go up? Please do your part to support WNYC's online services. Click the ePledge button to make your gift now. And thanks.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Well, Lieutenant Colombo. I must say, you turn up at the oddest times, don't
you? Listen, I hope you don't mind my coming in that way, you know, but the door was open and I just let myself in.
No, no. How'd you get here? By magic carpet? I didn't see your car outside.
Oh, no, I pulled around back and I put it in the shade. You know, the sun raises hell with the paint.
Oh, sensible. Well, what brings you up here to the wilds?
Well, I'll tell you, I heard you and Mrs. Ferris talk so much about this place and you made it sound so terrific, and believe me, you weren't exaggerating, because this is magnificent. And, you know, since I got a two-week vacation coming up, I said to myself, go on down there and check out the area. Look to see. Maybe you can rent a cabin.
Lieutenant, you're not going to tell me you drove down here just to look for a vacation spot, are you?
Why else would I come?
You're wasting your time.
Fans of TV's Columbo will understand why Peter Falk titled his new memoir Just One More Thing. It's his character's signature line, usually delivered just as he's about to nail the murderer. Mr. Falk has starred in more than 40 films, guest starred on many other TV shows. He's a respected stage actor and a visual artist. But for most of us, he'll always be Lieutenant Columbo. His book is published by Carolyn Graff, and it's a pleasure to welcome the five-time Emmy winner to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
So wasn't that clip that we opened with directed by Steven Spielberg and written by Stephen Bochco?
It sounds that way. That was a very early show. It could have been maybe the first.
I think it was. Book. It was from Murder by the Book, which is the first show in the series.
I think it was our first show.
Did you have any idea? Spielberg was just a kid at the time, wasn't he?
He was just a kid, and I had no idea that... where he was headed, but I do remember this. I remember that for the first time on any television show that I had ever done, the scene started and I didn't know where the camera was. And that's a pleasure, because the camera for actors is the same as the camera for everybody else. When it's pointed at your face, you tighten up and you become self-conscious because you know you're being filmed. But in this particular case, Spielberg had the camera across the street on the probably the 13th floor of the building.
So would that be the best way for you to work, generally with the camera hidden somewhere?
I would love it.
Does it bother you that people identify you so closely with Columbo?
I think if that bothered me, you would have sent me away somewhere. What could be better for an actor? What could be luckier for an actor to have a character like that to play, a character that I personally love so much and I personally enjoyed so much, and everybody got a kick out of him? Nothing better could ever happen to an actor.
Well, the reason I ask is, you know, there's this film, Hollywoodland, in which George Reeves is really unhappy that he's become Superman in everybody's mind, and he has greater aspirations. Perhaps in your case, you'd already established yourself as an actor who had a wide range, so maybe it wasn't as limiting for you as it would have been for him.
Perhaps that might be true. Columbo really, prior to Columbo, I had a little reputation, and people in the business knew me. But Columbo exploded all over the world. That was made a huge difference.
And you got to play a guy on the right side of the law, because early in your career, You received Oscar nominations for Murder Incorporated, Pocketful of Miracles, and you were playing gangsters. were you worried then that you'd be stereotyped as a criminal?
As a matter of fact, I was, in a sense. Those first two pictures, can you imagine this? I'm an actor. I'm in Greenwich Village, New York, and I'm doing plays. I'm making $10 a week during rehearsal, and when the play opens, I'm making $30 a week. I have a following. There's my mother and my father. There were the girls from Ossining High School and my cousin in New Jersey. They knew I was an actor. Beyond that, not much else. And Hollywood, in the person of 20th Century Fox, they come to New York. They're going to make a movie. And they brought with them the two stars, and they were going to use local actors to play the gangsters. And I got cast as the lead gangster. Colorful character, Abe Kid Twist Relis.
And Murder Incorporated.
It was Murder Incorporated. And you know, most of the people didn't know at that time that there was a group of gangsters that were hired by other gangsters. This group had a specialty. Their specialty was murder. So if a group of gangsters wanted somebody murdered, they went to Murder Incorporated. And that was the guy that I was playing. He was the head guy. So I had no idea that being in that part and playing that part in New York, that that was going to lead to an Academy Award.
Well, it was almost like a Richard Widmark kind of a thing, where people then thought of you as that character.
Except
you weren't throwing old ladies down the stairs.
Yeah, but when you wanted a gangster, you called Falk. That was me.
So you turned Sinatra down originally when he offered you a role in Robin and the Seven Hoods.
Yeah, I explained to him. I said, first of all, the phone rang, and it's Frank Sinatra. I had spent a little time with Frank prior to that. I was on an elevator once, and he got on the elevator.
So you were
and
close
he got
buddies.
Off at the sixth floor. I was taken aback by the fact it was him on the phone, and he said, you know, we're going to make a movie with the boys, and I'd like you to be in it. And I told him the truth. I said, first of all, I'm overwhelmed by it, but the truth was I was up for a part of a doctor. And I thought, sooner or later, I have to play somebody who knows how to read. I have to, and here's a chance to play a part of somebody who has a diploma hanging on the wall. And I explained it to Frank, and he couldn't have been better. He said, listen, I understand. You want to play a doctor, go ahead, but know that the part that I want you for, that will be available until the day we start shooting. So if you don't get the doctor, give me a call.
And you didn't get the doctor.
And I gave him a call.
You did wind up playing a doctor on Ben Casey, so you've been a doctor. But you had a diploma. You got a master's in public administration, worked as an efficiency expert for Connecticut, and you also applied for the CIA, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. You know, I asked this question, and I think this is a question that everybody is interested about themselves. How did I end up where I ended up?
As an actor.
As an actor. And most people could look back and say, how did I end up doing what I'm doing? How did that happen? I graduated from high school in 1945. I didn't become an actor until 1957, 12 years later. So what in the hell was I doing during those 12 years? Well, one of the things I was doing, I was hired as an efficiency expert for the state of Connecticut. And the first day on the job, I couldn't find the office. So obviously, I wasn't cut out for that kind of work.
But then the CIA, they turned you down because you'd gone to Yugoslavia and worked on building railroads for Tito. Did they think that that kind of tainted you?
Yeah, you know, that was during the McCarthy era, and there was a lot of hysteria regarding people who might be communist or red or pink or whatever color they had. What happened with me, I was very attracted to a girl, and she was in Paris, and the day I graduated from college, I hopped on a boat and went over. She was waiting for me, and I was waiting to meet her, and we got there. And I'm not much for going to museums. No, that didn't appeal to me. But something else happened. Marshal Tito, the head of Yugoslavia, he told Joe Stalin, the head of Russia, to shove it.
And got away with it.
And got away with it. But what that meant was Americans, people from the West, could for the very first time go behind the Iron Curtain. And you couldn't do that before. And she said, or I said, let's go. Had a Jeep. We had a little Cocker Spaniel. And we drove over the Alps and into Trieste. And there we were.
But you did get to play a CIA agent later when you were in the in-laws. And maybe we could listen to a little clip from that.
Oh, good.
You know, back when Kennedy was president, you saw the picture in the office?
Yes, I did.
He was crazy about me.
I was very impressed.
Honey, do you have a check?
Listen, let me ask you about that picture. What did that inscription mean? At least we tried.
Bay of Pigs. I referred to the Bay of Pigs.
You were involved with the Bay of Pigs?
Involved? That was my idea. I'll get this shot.
The Bay of Pigs.
You win some, you lose some.
You win some, you lose some.
So, at a certain point, you went from being a hood to a guy who did comedy.
I was lucky in terms of the in-laws. That had a strange beginning. One day I got a call from Alan, and he said, do you want to make a remake of whatever the hell the picture was? It was a previous picture. I might remember it and I might not. But it was a picture he had made with Jimmy Kahn, and the picture did pretty good.
You're talking about Alan Arkin.
Alan Arkin, yeah. And I said, well, if they want to make a remake of it, that's fine with me. And I met with Alan. And he said to me, do you really want to make a remake of it? I never saw the picture that they wanted to make a remake of. I didn't want to say that I never saw it. And I said, well, if that's what they want to do, that's fine with me.
That was Freebie and the Bean, wasn't it?
That's exactly right. Thank you very much, Leonard. Thank you, Freebie and the Bean. That was the picture. And Alan, he was lukewarm on making a remake of that. But actually, he and the writer of The In-Laws, gosh, I gotta do better remembering names.
It was Andrew Bergman, I think.
It was Andrew Bergman.
One of the funniest screenwriters.
One of the funniest screenwriters that ever lived. And this was a genius script. And Alan was aware of it, and when he said, well, I'm not so crazy about the Freebie and the Bean, I said, fine, it's all right with me. But then Alan said this to me. He said, you know, I would like to do a comedy, you and me, and the thing that I would like to have is that the two guys don't know each other. I didn't know what in the hell he was talking about. It sounded good to me. I said, fine.
Sounds like a Cassavetes idea.
Yes, right. But 6 months later, he called up and he said, I got that script and you got the best part. So, and that was The In-Laws.
But we still haven't ascertained as to how you became an actor. You say it was 15 years after you graduated from college, or 10 years, I guess. And at a certain point, you're on Broadway appearing in The Iceman Cometh with Jason Robards. That's a pretty big leap from efficiency expert.
Well, you know, I got lucky. When I, for some curious reason, I got a master's degree in public administration. How that happened, I'll never know. I didn't like the subjects. I had no aptitude for the subjects. But it was a program training young men to work in the bureaucracy in Washington, D.C. And I finally put into words one thing that I knew, and that was this. Peter, you are not born or suited to work 9 to 5 in an office. That I knew. So when we graduated and got a master's degree in public administration, they were going to take us to Washington to get a job there. And I said, "Oh, you're going to go work in some bureaucracy in Washington?" And then I had a brilliant idea. I said, "What I'll do is this. I'll become a spy." And I saw myself in Paris. I'm on the Champs-Élysées, and there's a beautiful Russian spy opposite me. So I went to Washington, and I applied at the CIA. Well, the guy looked at my resume, and he saw that I was in Yugoslavia once, and I was lifting rocks, and it was supposed to be building a railroad or something. And he said to me, "Son, here's my advice to you. You can't work at the CIA. In fact, you can't work in Washington. So go someplace else and try and get a job."
But why acting? You wound up sitting with Eva LaGallian,
who
really encouraged you to go into acting full time.
I got real lucky. What happened, Leonard, was that I got a job in Hartford, Connecticut, and in Hartford, Connecticut, they had a fantastic community theater. So my day started at night. Every night I went, and I was either in a play or I was rehearsing a play. And then I saw an ad that Eva LaGallian was giving a course for professional actors. So I signed up. I lied. Mm-hmm. I said I was a professional actor. She was a very formidable woman. And I was late because I had to drive from Hartford to to wherever it was. And one day she leveled me and asked me, "Why are you always late?" And I told her the truth. I said, I'm not an actor. Oh, I said, "I have to drive from Hartford." She said, "What do you do there? There's no theater there." And I said, "I'm not an actor." And she said, "Well, you should be. Now sit down." Well, I heard, "Well, you should be." And I didn't stay for the full class. I left after about 15 minutes, drove back to Hartford, went into the boss, and quit. And he said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'm going to be an actor."
And Peter Falk has appeared in over 40 motion pictures, numerous plays, many television programs. He has written a memoir called Just One More Thing, Stories from My Life, which is published by Carroll and Graff. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us.
Don't believe truth. Just don't believe truth. Archie, I'm telling you, don't believe truth.
That is the truth now. You see, the truth will never kill you. Lies will. Not cigarettes, not alcohol. Lies does. Lies' intentions. That'll kill you. They'll kill you before cancer in the heart. Did you know that?
Yeah, give me a cigarette, will you?
What was that? Was that from The In-Laws?
That's from Husbands, Peter Falk.
Oh, that's from Husbands.
In a film from John Cassavetes, one of a number of films that Peter Falk made with John Cassavetes. He tells about that experience and pretty much everything else that's happened in his life in a new memoir called Just One More Thing, Stories from My Life, published by Carroll and Graff. How did you wind up working with Cassavetes? Because it seems like a match made in heaven.
The first time I ever spoke to John, it was at a Laker game. We were on the hot dog line, and I don't know what we said to one another, but whatever it was brief, because we wanted to get our dogs and get back to our seats and not to miss the beginning of the second half. Then I think, I know what happened after that. Yes, Elaine May wrote a script called Mikey and Nikki. I love that script. And she wanted me to play Mikey, and she said, "Gosh, Cassavetes would be a great Nikki." And I said, "Why don't I see if I can arrange a meeting?"
You had to go to another Laker game.
It would have been great if we wasn't at a Laker game. It turns out we were having lunch at the Paramount Commissary. And I said to him, Elaine wrote the script, and I'm going to be in it. And I told him a little bit about the characters. I said they knew each other as kids, and now they were petty entrepreneurs, illegal entrepreneurs, and he said, I'll do it.
And that was that?
No, that wasn't that, because I looked at him and I said, John, I'm serious about this, and so is Elaine. So let's talk seriously. He said, I said I'd do it. What do you want? And I said, I'd like you to ask some intelligent questions.
You're making it difficult for him.
Well, that started him. He had a great time with that. He started out fairly soft. What do you think? I'm like you? Worried? Are the critics going to like it? Is the audience going to like it? Is my part good? Is your part better? And then he was up on his feet, and the whole lunchroom, the whole auditorium, everybody could hear him. And when he got done, here's the last thing he said was, she wrote it, and you're going to be in it, and that's all I have to know. And he sat down. And that was true. That's the way he felt.
Well, everybody thinks that all of his movies were improvised, but they weren't. He really wrote most of those scripts, didn't he?
It's an exaggeration to think. John was a hell of a writer. John wrote every day of his life. He was a born writer.
Yeah, we had Jenna Rollins here who said that, you know, maybe the first ones were a bit improvised, but after that, and people would improvise in rehearsal, but then there was a script.
Yes. I mean, there's a time for improvisation, but obviously that fantastic speech of Jenna's in Woman Under the Influence, that speech where she shed her sanity page by page, word by word, starting out as a normal person and 6 minutes later was ready to be carted away. That was all written. It was a terrific performance.
Most people know that you have a glass eye, the result of childhood cancer. Was that ever an issue in your career, especially in film work where there are a lot of close-ups?
You know, it's hard. I think it's almost impossible for a young actor today or for most people today to conceive of somebody deciding to be an actor and never considering for one moment ever doing television or ever doing movies. I was a stage actor, and that's all I wanted to do, nothing else. And it never occurred to me. As a matter of fact, when I became an actor, I didn't own a television set. I had only seen television once by accident. I happened to be in somebody's house on a Sunday, and maybe it was Milton Berle, and that was it. So that when I had a meeting with the agent, the first agent I ever met, and he looked at me, and he was very grim because he was going to give me bad news. And he said, young man, I hope you realize that you will never be able to do movies or television. And I said, I never thought of doing movies or television. And he was talking about it because of your eye. I said, don't worry about it. I just want to be on the stage. And that was it. So times have changed.
But you did a lot of early television. You were on Studio One, Kraft Television Theater, Robert Montgomery Presents, Play of the Week. On the other hand, didn't Harry Cohn, the head of Columbia Pictures, tell you, for the same money, I can get an actor with two eyes?
Yes. Yes, I did those television shows. But at that time, I was really acting off-Broadway. And we were doing O'Neill and O'Casey and, you know.
And television was like theater in those days. It was live, usually. And
yes, there was. I remember one time we were doing a live television show, and the camera that was on, that was pointing at you, had a red light on. And something happened, and the red light went off. And there were three of us actors on the stage. We all saw the light go off, and we panicked. Where do we go? But the camera that they cut to was in back of us. So what the American audience saw was three actors running around like chickens with their heads cut off.
Well, Steven Spielberg must have been directing that one, too. Meanwhile, you did a lot of things. Alfred Hitchcock Presents The Untouchables, Naked City, Dr. Kildare. You even played a Fidel Castro lookalike like on a Twilight Zone episode.
Yeah, that's right.
Did that grow out of the time you got arrested in Havana?
No. That was something. I got cast my first movie. You know, when I decided to be an actor and I told my father, did I tell you this story? That when I said to my father, I made a decision and he said, what? I said, I'm going to be an actor. And he said, you mean you're going to paint your face and make an ass of yourself for the rest of your life? So whenever whenever I would see him, he would say, so what's happening? What's new? What's going on? And I'd say, I got this. And he said, how much are they paying you? I'd say, well, it's $10 a week. And $30 when the show opens. He never answered me when I told him that. He just lowered his head into his hand and rubbed his brow. He never answered me. And then once he said, so what's happening? Anything? I said, good news. He said, what? I said, I'm going to be in a movie. How much are they paying you? I said, $500 a week. When do you start? I said, this Sunday. He said, this is what I want you to do. You work down there for 1 week, then call me, and I want to know if they like what you're doing for them. I went down there, and they changed the schedule. I didn't work on Monday. They said, go out and play golf. I didn't work Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday. I played golf all week. So when I called my father, and he said, well, do they like what you're doing? I said, I didn't work yet. What? You were supposed to be there on Monday. Were you there on Monday, yes or no? I said, yes, I was there. So what did you do? I said, well, they changed the schedule. So what did you do? Did you carry food in? What did you do? Well, when I got done and he realized that for 5 days I didn't do anything, he went around town saying, that's show business. That's the greatest business. They got the kid down there for 5 days in a row. He played golf, and then they handed him $500.
He thought, now you've really had a decent job.
Right.
Is it true that they originally offered the part of Columbo to Lee J. Cobb and Bing Crosby, and they both turned it down?
I know that they offered it to Bing Crosby. That I know for sure. And when they told me the reason Bing Crosby turned it down, he said he liked the part, and he said he liked the script, but he had a golf tournament. And ever since then, I've been eternally grateful to the game of golf. The Lee Cobb thing, that sounds, I don't have a vivid recollection of that, but that sounds true, that they went to him too.
Well, he would have been a good fit, I think.
Yeah.
Both of them would have been.
Yeah.
But you were a perfect fit. And then the first Columbo was made as a standalone TV movie.
It was, yes. What they wanted, actually, when they first came to me, they wanted to make Columbo into a series. And
but it began as a stage play, didn't it?
It was a stage play. And Thomas Mitchell was a very well-known Hollywood character.
He usually
actor.
Played Mexicans in those movies. He was always in the Mexican town.
He was a Mexican?
Perspiring.
Really?
Well, no, but he used to play them, I remember.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, at any rate, he was the first Columbo, and they were, but it never came into Broadway. And then they made another television show out of it, and another actor that I know, Bert Fried, he played Columbo. And not much happened with that, but the boys, Lincoln Levinson, the writers, they never gave up on that character. And they said, we're going to do it again. And they hired me, and we were off and running.
And Stephen Bochco and Steven Spielberg, not a bad beginning. The series was part of, it wasn't like a TV series today. You did, what, six a year as part of NBC Mystery Wheel series?
Yeah, in the beginning they came to me and they wanted to do one a week. And I said, no, it's impossible. You can't write one a week. And a couple of years went by, and then they came up with, which was something very smart. They said it will be part of a wheel, and you will be on once a month, and other shows will be on, McMillan and Wife, and blah, blah, blah. And so I think that we usually used to do maybe eight or nine a year, and that was practical.
And you wonder why they don't do more of that now.
Yes.
But is it true that the raincoat, the famous raincoat, was something you brought from your own closet?
Yes, that's absolutely true, yeah. I remember they had laid out on a bed. We were going to start shooting in about 3 days. And on this bed, they had a collection of suits, green suits, black suits, light suits. They had a driving coat. Can you imagine Columbo putting on a driving coat to drive his car? And I instantly felt disappointed. And the reason I was disappointed is that great characters, you can see what they wear. When Charlie Chaplin, you know exactly what he wore. And whatchamacallit, on the Jackie Gleason show.
Art Carney.
Art Carney. I can see that costume. I can see that hat, and I can see the vest. And that's what makes a character distinct. So why the raincoat popped into my mind, I'll never know.
But well, what did. Happened? Did you have to wear that same raincoat all those years?
I did.
It never wore out?
And I wore that raincoat. I bought that raincoat 7 years before we ever shot Columbo, and we shot Columbo, God only knows. Yes.
Well, 30 years or so on
it's,
and off.
It is, Leonard, it's very fragile.
What about...
But I take good care of it. You know what I do? I put a saucer of milk out for it every night.
Got to treat it right.
Right.
There's also the cigar and the ancient Peugeot that he drives. Were those your decisions as well?
Yes. They said, I remember, they yelled out of the window, Dick.
This is Richard Levinson and
yeah,
William O. Link, who created
Lincoln
the show.
Levinson. They yelled out the window, go get a car. Go down to the garage and get a car. We're going to have to start shooting the day after tomorrow. They moved the schedule up. I went down, and there was 100 cars there. They all looked alike, Pontiac, Chevrolets, and nothing hit my eye. So I was leaving, and you had to walk up a ramp. And when I got to the top of the ramp, I turned around, and looking down, there it was. There was that little beauty. You could barely see it. But it had the perfect touch. It had a flat tire. And I said, that car matches the raincoat. And that's when we got the car. So we got the car only 2 days before we started the shoot.
Peter Falk is with me. He's written a memoir called Just One More Thing, Stories from My Life. What about the dog? Was that your dog?
That wasn't my dog. That wasn't even my idea. That was Nick Colasanto's idea. Nick was an actor from New York, and I knew him back here in the city. And then he became a director, and he came to me. This might have been the third show that we ever shot, third or fourth show. And he said, I got a terrific idea. Columbo should have a dog. I said, Nick, we got the car, we got the raincoat, we got the cigar, we're gilding the lily, we don't need a dog. He said, would you take a look at it? I said, I'll look at it, but I'm afraid that we got enough already. And he took me in, and this basset hound was so lifeless. It was laying out on the table. It could barely move. But there was something so touching about this dog. And he was very old. And you know what the problem was? The problem was the dog passed.
And then you had to find another
one. And we had to find another one. And the problem with finding another one was they had... I'd be ready to shoot. I said, let's go. They said, well, we have to wait for the dog. I said, well, where's the dog? The dog was in makeup. They had they had to put clown white on the second dog to make him look like the first dog.
Now, you directed fairly early in the series. Had you always wanted to direct?
I always wanted to direct, yeah. And they didn't want me to direct.
Was it a good experience?
Oh, it was a terrific experience. I enjoyed it a lot. Yeah.
Why haven't you done more?
I
mean, there are a lot of one-eyed directors.
There are.
Andre de Tote, for example. He's pretty great.
The reason I haven't done more is there's so much to be done on it when we make a Columbo. A lot of writing has to be done. A lot of rewriting has to be done. And when I direct, that means the director can't start finding the locations while we're finishing the previous Columbo. So that slows things up.
But you wound up having John Cassavetes direct one of the shows, in fact. And he also appeared with you. And, boy, so many other people. Patrick McGoohan of the Prisoner fame, but also Janet Leigh, Ray Milland, Lee Grant, Jack Cassidy, Kim Hunter, Lawrence Harvey, Johnny Cash, and Little Richard.
Johnny Cash, you know, Johnny Cash actually contacted us. I didn't think of
Johnny
Cash.
He wanted to be on?
Cash, yeah. He seen a show, and he said, I'd like to do it. So it was great having him. That was terrific.
In your book, you write that finding good clues was the most difficult part of doing the show.
You got a murder mystery, but you know who did it. So not only do you know who did it, you know how he did it. Why are the people watching? For one reason. They want to see how Columbo's going to catch him. So you better have a really brilliant, fresh, original final scene. And that put a lot of pressure on the writing to come up with that final scene.
It's an international show, so are you recognized wherever you go?
Yeah. Yep. I say in the book I could be in Alaska and two Eskimos could come around the corner and they would start to smile and point and say, yo, Lieutenant Columbo.
Last year, you starred in two movies, Checking Out and The Thing About My Folks, and then you have a new one coming out called Retirement that's opening soon?
Yeah.
And also, you've continued to make time for appearing on the stage. Prisoner's Second Avenue, you toured with Glengarry Glenn Ross, you were in Arthur Miller's Mr. Peters Connections. The theater still your love?
Yeah, but I mean, it's very tough to fit it in. It really is tough to fit it in. But that reminds me, the Arthur Miller thing. The Signature Theater here in New York, they had a program where each year they would honor our great playwrights. And they honored Arthur Miller that year. And he had to write a new play, and I was in it. And the opening... not the opening night, the first time that we played it for an audience, he was there and he came backstage. And I was anxious to hear how he thought about the thing. But and he said something about it, but he didn't talk about it a lot. And then somehow or other, the movie The Misfits came up. And The Misfits had big names in it.
Marilyn Monroe. Clark Gable,
Montgomery Clift. But I was interested in another name, the name of James Barton. And James Barton, the actors know who James Barton is. He was one of the great theater actors of our time. And he played the lead in the original, Iceman Cometh. So I asked Arthur, what about James Barton? And he said this. Me and Gadge Kazan, the director, we thought that Barton would be great in this role. We knew he was a drinker. He was famous for... He had a very loose elbow. But we thought he'd be great, and we knew he needed the money. So we hired James Barton. And he said, one afternoon, I walked into a saloon, and there was James Barton. And he was sitting there with a six-year-old kid. And I said, James, who is this kid? And Barton said, it's my grandson. I'm taking care of him. Oh, really? Yeah. And Barton said, but the kid, yeah, this kid's, he's a little different. You got to watch him every minute. If I take my eye off him for 10 seconds, he'll run off to school.
Well, you might want to run off to the 92nd Street Y tonight, the MacCor Center at 35 West 67th Street, because it's 7 o'clock. Peter Falk will be telling more stories. You could check out ticket information by going to our show page at WNYC.org. The book is Just One More Thing, Stories from My Life, by Peter Falk, published by Carol and Graff. Oh, and Mr. Falk, just one more thing.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopez Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.